this, I think, with the, with this discussion, with a few very distinguished people who have had the courage to put their views on the line and express themselves on this terribly important issue. It's also timely, given what is happening in Washington, that Secretary Hoops was a consultant at the time of the organization of the National Security Council. In terms of the persona dramatis, it's also timely that he served in the United States Marine Corps from 43 to 46. In order to get in the news, you just about have to have done that. He was born in Duluth. He did his degree in economics at Yale. He was an editorial writer for the Buffalo Evening News. His career within the area in which he'll be talking is very impressive and distinguished. Frank Elliott could fill in some of the footnotes in the interstices, but he served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1948 to 1953. He was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs from 1965 to 1966. He was Under Secretary of the Air Force from 1967 to 1969. He's been a partner of Cressup, McCormick, and Paget, Vice President, Corporate Director, and Head of the Washington Office. He's served as President of the Association, American Association of Publishers. He holds a number of corporate directorships, Tally Industries, Inc., and so on. He's was consultant to the President's Committee on U.S. Information Activities Abroad, served on the Rockefeller Brothers Fund Special Studies Project in the area of his subject. He's the author of a number of books, including The Limits of Intervention, 1969, The Devil and John Foster Dulles, 1973, and co-author of Eye Power in 1979. It's a great privilege to have Secretary Hoops with us today.
Thank you very much. This is a marvelously more informal than I had anticipated. I thought I'd be speaking from a rostrum to assembled thousands. So I will try to proceed as informally as I can, but I may be partially reading from this text and partially speaking to you. The arms control spectrum is a kind of cat's cradle, and you can only say so much about it even given an infinite amount of time, and you can also enter the cradle from various points. And I thought, just as a practical matter, I would talk about the issues in the context of Star Wars, because despite its non-existence, this has become the central factor and certainly the bone of contention, the central bone of contention in U.S.-Soviet relations. So let me go directly to the central issue of Star Wars. Can it work? Does it make any political sense? Or does it really promise a vast and dangerous new arms race in space? I made up my own mind on this issue at least 3 or 4 years ago. I think there are two fundamental reasons why Star Wars cannot work. One is scientific complexity, and two is the Soviet ability to take countermeasures. While the scientific community does include a few optimists, I think the far greater weight of opinion is that technology does not offer even a slim prospect of effective population defense, either now or in the distant future. The obvious problem is the destructive power of a single nuclear warhead. A single warhead can destroy an entire city. 100 warheads used against our cities could utterly destroy the United States and, conversely, the Soviet Union. But 100 warheads is only 1% of the available strategic weaponry on each side, and there is no conceivable way that even the most marvelous defense system could prevent leakage against nuclear missiles to the extent of 1%. In that astonishing address to the nation in 1983, in January, President Reagan proclaimed the vision of an entirely new strategy. A Star Wars defense, he said, would replace the morally uncongenial doctrine of deterrence, whereunder our security really rests on the implicit or explicit threat to reduce our adversaries to rubble if they should attack us. And notwithstanding the torrent of commentary since that time, the president, at least, appears not to have wavered from his original view. In 1985, and I think even more recently, he said, but this was a 1985 speech to the National Space Club, he said, "We need to render obsolete the balance of terror, or mutual assured destruction as it is called. Now this is not, and should never be misconstrued as, just another method of protecting missile silos." So I think we can say, to the extent that the president knows what he thinks, he sees Star Wars as a population defense. That is his, in many respects, major vision for America. What he is telling us, I think, is that we can have a nice, clean, technological, once-and-for-all solution to the threat of nuclear destruction. Moreover, we can have it unilaterally. Once the defense system is in place, neither the Soviet Union nor any other potential adversary would ever again pose a nuclear threat to us or our allies. The competition in strategic offensive weapons and other forms of military technology would somehow come to a benign halt. The promise is breathtaking. Let's look first at the technical problems. And I speak really not as a technician, but as a kind of lay observer of technical problems of this kind. Generally speaking, the Star Wars proposal can be understood to consist of three layers of defense, although some people in their infinite search for simplicity are now talking about seven. These three layers are, first, the effort to intercept Soviet missiles in their boost phase as they rise out of their silos. Second, the effort to destroy them in mid-flight. And third, the effort to provide what are called terminal defenses immediately around the U.S. missile silos against those Soviet missiles that get through the first two layers. Terminal defense could clearly be built with existing technology, but not without violating the ABM treaty. But the boost phase and mid-range layers are entirely in the realm of speculation. Sensors and weapons designed to find and kill Soviet missiles as they lift off and fly through the air would have to be based in space. According to scientists like Sidney Drell, and I understand he has been here, and Harold Brown, the accuracy required to track targets, aim laser beams, and keep them on target is well beyond current technology. Moreover, the laser intensities, so-called, required to destroy missiles are, in Harold Brown's words, perhaps a million or more times greater than anything that has been achieved. There are also daunting problems of cost and logistics. A typical set of orbiting laser beam weapons, for example, would probably require several hundred satellites, each carrying 10 tons of fuel. Intercept in the boost phase would have to be accomplished in something between 3 and 6 minutes. That means the defense system would have to be activated by computers, removing the response decision from human judgment and control. It would mean placing the issue of war or peace in the hands of computers. To Dr. Herbert York, a former director of defense research and engineering, that would be the ultimate human absurdity. Harold Brown believes such a system might be mistakenly activated merely by the flight of a few Soviet test missiles and would thus automatically fire at those missiles or at the Soviet defense system. This, he says with studied understatement, would not necessarily provoke a nuclear war, but it certainly could create a serious crisis. Not unreasonably, I think, the Soviets regard Star Wars as a potential nuclear gun. That is, a system that could shoot first from platforms in space. And they see it as a potential first-strike threat that would be hovering permanently over Soviet airspace. This would force them to put their own retaliatory weapons on an automatic hair trigger. But they have the gravest doubts about the reliability of their own computers and the other elements of their command and control system in a posture of automatic so-called launch on warning. They see a grave danger that the computers might activate a Soviet weapons response to a false alarm. And I suggest that we should also have the gravest misgivings about the reliability of our own computers, which are a good deal more sophisticated than the Soviets. Scientific capability is arguable. Some scientists believe that Star Wars could ultimately work in certain circumstances. Most, as I say, do not. But far more obvious, I think, is the Soviet ability to neutralize a Star Wars defense through countermeasures. And here the scientific community is virtually unanimous in believing that a wide range of countermeasures against missile defenses are available. Also, that they are far less expensive and less technically demanding to deploy than the defenses themselves. For example, our sensors would be subject to blinding and jamming. Our orbiting weapons could be trailed by Soviet space mines that could be detonated on command. And here I think it's important to understand that these orbiting weapons would be in a fixed orbit. They would go like this around the globe, so that it would be very easy to create a space mine that simply trailed the weapon 50 yards, 100 yards, half a mile away, and be detonated on signal. And any defense can be overwhelmed by sheer numbers. Dr. Richard DeLauer, who was Mr. Reagan's first Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering in the first term, has said directly what every serious student of the subject knows. He said, with unconstrained proliferation of Soviet missiles, no defense system can work. A year ago, Zbigniew Brzezinski and Max Kampelman wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine asserting that we could build a splendid defense for only $60 billion that would fully cover all 1,100 Soviet missile silos. But suppose we did that, and suppose the Soviets then build an additional 1,000 or 2,000 silos. I think the point is here, we are not dealing with a static situation and cannot expect to. Zealous cheerleaders like Caspar Weinberger chastise critics of Star Wars by asserting they are the same people who said we couldn't get to the moon. But the analogy is really false. And perhaps Gerard Smith has touched on this point too. Because the effort to get to the moon was not complicated by the presence of an adversary. A platoon of hostile moon men with axes could have made it a disaster. As you are also probably aware, the professional operatives in the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative really dismiss the president's dream of an effective population defense, and they are busy trying to reshape the Reagan vision to develop a more limited program that would be confined essentially to terminal defenses around our land-based missile silos. Several things should be said about this quite different approach. First, it appears to be proceeding without the president's full understanding, for he continues to speak of Star Wars as a roof over the head of American families. Second, it can contribute nothing to population defense. Third, like the proposed full-scale Star Wars defense, it is aimed only at the intercontinental ballistic missile threat, that is to say, the missiles that come from the Soviet Union over the pole. It would provide little or no protection against cruise missiles or against ballistic missiles that might be fired in a low trajectory from Soviet submarines lying off our coasts. Fourth, it could not be built without violating the ABM Treaty. Fifth, if the purpose were really merely to provide local defense of land-based missiles, there is no need for this exotic panoply of incredibly complicated and expensive weapons and sensors based in space. Lastly, the U.S. cannot build, I think, even a significant local defense system without stimulating the same Soviet fears and countermeasures as would a full-scale defense. What is really astonishing to me is the persistent refusal of the administration's so-called defense intellectuals to face up to these implications. Either they pass over the hard facts or they simply assert that the Soviets will not respond by increasing their own offensive striking power. The Strategic Defense Initiative Director, General Abramson, for example, argues that when they see that we have embarked on a long-term effort to achieve an effective defense supported by a strong national will, then they will give up, he says, on the development of more offensive missiles and move in the same direction. It is this same strange mindset that appears to sustain the administration's equally astounding view that Star Wars is a major contribution to arms control. As the reasoning goes, once the Soviets realize that their aim to threaten the U.S. with a first strike has been permanently frustrated, then they will drastically devalue their own offensive missiles and be prepared, in effect, to negotiate them away. I submit that one must pause and ask, what in the world is going on here? For no serious observer of U.S.-Soviet relations believes any of this. This bizarre line of reasoning seems to reflect the remarkable tenacity of the president's dreamy vision, reinforced by the sycophancy, greed, and hype of those who stand to profit politically or financially from the program. It began with a presidential obsession with a dubious idea. It has gained momentum through the magnetic attraction of presidential power. Defense intellectuals, and I speak here, of course, generically, and there are exceptions, have concluded that Star Wars is the new big game in town, and that to retain their standing in the circle of influence, they must not reject it out of hand. Politicians and other assorted experts have, until now, visibly hedged their bets, although common sense and thus resistance is now beginning to penetrate the Congress. Defense contractors who doubt that Star Wars will ever work are nevertheless lining up at the Pentagon door, rubbing their hands. Thus has a vague notion of stardust and moonbeams been converted in about 3 years into what looks like becoming the great pork barrel in the sky. But the Reykjavik summit made it crystal clear, or should have made it crystal clear to most people, that for the most fundamental of reasons, Reagan cannot have his cake and eat it too. That is to say, cannot reach agreements with the Soviets on major reductions in offensive nuclear weapons and at the same time push ahead with the testing, development, and deployment of a strategic defense. If there were ever any doubt about that, the Reykjavik talks reaffirmed that the Soviet opposition to Star Wars is categorical and therefore that the inevitable consequence of pushing ahead beyond research will be an arms race in space without any apparent limit and probably beyond the control of either party. In my view, the Soviets are opposed to Star Wars not primarily because they doubt their ability to counter it, but because the effort would entail a great financial and technical strain and would embroil both superpowers in a vast new arms race. They see an arms race in space as futile, ultimately, but also as extremely dangerous and as crippling to their real hopes for economic revitalization. The Soviets appear to believe that if things go on as they are, they will eventually face an array of increasingly accurate American offensive weapons plus a possible, albeit unreliable, Star Wars defense. They reason that such a combination could cast doubt upon their second strike deterrent, leaving them vulnerable to an American first strike, or far more probably, to American political pressure that was based on a superficially plausible first strike threat. They are aware that some influential members of the Reagan entourage, especially the Pentagon civilians, see Star Wars as the dramatic vehicle for reestablishing U.S. strategic supremacy and restoring to U.S. policy the freedom of unilateral action on a global scale. I believe the president has been either naive or disingenuous about the consequences of Star Wars. In effect, he has been saying to the Kremlin, I want you to reduce your offensive weapons while at the same time accepting an American defense system that will greatly increase the barriers your reduced weapons must overcome in order to reach American targets. In the first Soviet reply, which was 1983, Yuri Andropov, then the premier, called Star Wars a bid to disarm the Soviet Union. In 1985, then Foreign Minister Gromyko provided a somewhat broader assessment. He said, "Let us say the Americans managed to put in effect their program, that they create a shield against ballistic missiles. But what is under that shield are missiles that can be hurled at the other side, at the Soviet Union, naturally in an extreme situation. They say this does not mean anything. They tell us the United States has no intention to strike the Soviet Union. We told them that in such a situation we have got to rely on your conscience, the conscience of Washington. First of all, we are not convinced that Washington has great reserves of this commodity. But we said, what if we were to change places? Would you think the same way? Would our conscience be enough for you? This argument was met by silence." Well, Gromyko's question is hardly irrelevant. If it were the Soviets who were hell-bent to develop a strategic missile defense, how would the United States react? In a rare moment of candor, Caspar Weinberger remarked about a year ago that an effective Soviet missile defense, and here I quote, would present one of the most frightening prospects I could imagine and would require building more and better U.S. offensive weapons. But to answer Gromyko's question, we really need not deal in hypothetical situations, for in the late 1960s, the Soviets did develop a very rudimentary, very ambiguous anti-ballistic missile system around Moscow. Did we at that point conclude that our land-based and sea-based missiles were henceforward obsolete? On the contrary, we countered directly with the development of what is called MIRV, the Multiple Independently Targetable Reentry Vehicle, the Hydra-headed missile, which was designed specifically to confuse and evade a Soviet defense system should it be fully built. Such is the momentum of the military-industrial complex that we deployed MIRV on a large scale even after we had reached agreement with the Soviets that neither side would deploy a serious ABM defense. The Pentagon merely changed the rationale for the weapon. The Soviets inevitably followed suit. Now, Soviet land-based MIRVs constitute the primary threat to the United States and provide the stimulus for the MX missile and the Star Wars defense. But the central fact, I think, is clear. Faced with Soviet defensive developments, however ambiguous, which we interpreted as efforts to deprive us of our second strike deterrent, the United States moved resolutely to assure that our weapons could still penetrate. There was in our policy councils no thought of giving up on the further development of offensive missiles. And I think it's axiomatic that the Soviets will react to Star Wars in exactly the same way for exactly the same reasons. I think it is crystal clear, as I said at the outset, that Star Wars, despite its non-existence, has thus become the central factor and the chief bone of contention in our relations with the Soviets. It has become so largely because of the president's passionate promotion of it. In this sense, one can say that the great communicator has inadvertently brought U.S.-Soviet relations to a threshold of a new opportunity. The Star Wars is useful in its present incipient stage as a bargaining chip. It can, I think, as is evidenced at Reykjavik, be bargained away for major Soviet concessions that would measurably improve world stability and would also create a political atmosphere conducive to further constructive agreements. At Reykjavik, Reagan could have obtained a 50% across-the-board reduction in Soviet and American strategic weapons within 5 years in exchange for an agreement to keep Star Wars in the laboratory bottle for 10 years. The Soviet missiles constitute an existing, threatening reality. The Star Wars program is a congeries of Strangelovian dreams and conflicting purposes based largely on non-existent technologies. To dispassionate observers, this kind of offense-defense trade-off would have been a very good deal for the United States, and indeed, I think, for the stability of the world. But the President balked at such an agreement, and thereby dramatically reaffirmed the depth of his personal obsession with this dream of an invulnerable shield against nuclear attack. He and some of his colleagues seemed determined to develop, test, and deploy a defense system as soon as possible, and do not want their decisions complicated by a requirement for Soviet concurrence. This position was reinforced a week or two after Reykjavik by the Schultz-Shevardnadze meeting in Vienna, which ended in disagreement. At that meeting, the Soviets proposed the immediate convening of a panel of experts to examine the differences in interpretation of the ABM Treaty as a basis for a more precise understanding of what is and what is not permitted by way of research in the laboratory and testing in the laboratory under the ABM Treaty. The U.S. side rejected the proposal. And we draw that from there the inference that the Reagan administration wants to be free to announce its own much broader interpretation of the treaty whenever it is ready to take the next definitive step with SDI. Reagan's performance at Reykjavik was revealing, I think, of his instinctive worldview that extends well beyond SDI to his concept of America in relation to the rest of mankind. When Gorbachev accepted the idea of a 50% cut but demanded restrictions on Star Wars, Reagan moved to up the ante on offensive missiles. He proposed eliminating all ballistic missiles within 10 years, arguing that if they were all eliminated, then SDI would not threaten anyone. When Gorbachev replied that in a world of no ballistic missiles, SDI would have no purpose or justification, Reagan answered that it would be a prudent insurance policy against cheating or terrorists. Leaving aside for a moment the Mad Hatter quality of this bargaining, it revealed that Reagan was willing to give up almost everything to save Star Wars, including the basic nuclear deterrent that underpins NATO strategy and holds the alliance together. And as you know, we have had since Reykjavik major protests from European allies that seem to have produced a falling away by the administration from that extreme position. From this curious episode, one cannot escape the conclusion that Mr. Reagan's conceptual dream is of an America restored to the serene independence of a much earlier historical period, an invulnerable America with the power to act alone and with impunity on a global scale, protected not only from enemy nuclear attack, but also from the need for entangling alliances, from the need to respond to the messy problems of weak and unstable countries, an America free to choose either isolation or engagement, either unilateral or collective action. Above all, an America protected from the supreme need to recognize the inescapable mutual vulnerability of the United States and the USSR, and thus from the imperative to work out a political arrangement for stable coexistence. Reykjavik starkly revealed what many had long suspected, that this president, in his heart of hearts, still dreams of an America splendidly alone, able to remove the national vulnerability to nuclear destruction by a unilateral technological fix. It may be a quite understandable, if adolescent, yearning. It is unfortunately utterly at odds with the facts, historical, political, military, and economic. I find it sad and regrettable, to understate the case somewhat, that currently we are led in this country by this strange, stubborn dreamer from the land of celluloid happy endings, while the Soviet Union is led by a man who has demonstrated more concentrated, realistic, and sensible thinking on the nuclear problem, certainly than any other previous leader of the USSR. The evidence is impressive that the new Soviet leadership has made a fundamental judgment that nuclear weapons cannot be used to gain or preserve any valued political goal. Gorbachev has said, "Nuclear weapons harbor a hurricane with the potential of sweeping the human race from the face of the earth, that nuclear war is therefore suicidal and must be avoided." From this judgment have flowed his remarkable efforts to stabilize the relationship, to deal on a range of issues, especially to reach an arms control agreement that will halt the gathering arms race in space. While the ultimate seriousness of these efforts remains to be fully proved in negotiations, they appear to be far more than a tactical ploy. They appear to proceed from a fundamental new Soviet assessment of the present and prospective world situation. And let me just give you a couple of quotes in closing from Gorbachev's marathon five-hour speech to the 27th Party Congress last February when he was speaking to fellow communists. He developed at that time, at some length, the thesis that Lenin's doctrine of a final, unavoidable clash between the two systems had been rendered inoperative by weapons technology. And he said this in summing up, "This means realizing that in the present situation there is no alternative to cooperation and interaction between all countries. Thus the objective, I emphasize objective, conditions have taken place in which confrontation between capitalism and socialism can proceed only and exclusively in forms of peaceful competition and peaceful contest." His comprehensive arms control proposals of last January 15 were far more reasonable and forthcoming than any previous Soviet proposals, and they made a special effort to address the Western concerns about verification. He has now, as you know, four times extended a unilateral Soviet ban on nuclear testing and invited the U.S. to follow his lead. And he said this in connection with the first extension. He said, "In the absence of a positive U.S. response, the Soviets have a right to resume testing." But he wished to avoid being trapped in that kind of familiar action-reaction syndrome. And he said this, "If one were to follow the usual logic of the arms race, that presumably would have been the thing to do. But the point is that it is precisely that notorious logic that has to be resolutely repudiated. We are making yet another attempt in this direction. Otherwise, the process of military rivalry will become an avalanche, and any control over the course of events will become impossible." Until Reykjavik, there was really no pattern to the response of the Reagan administration to these initiatives. Some useful negotiations were held looking to the reduction of so-called intermediate missiles in Europe. But the administration gave Gorbachev a very cold shoulder on nuclear testing, and there was no movement on proposals to reduce strategic offensive weapons. What will eventually be salvaged or reshaped from the promising confusions of Reykjavik is unclear. It does seem reasonable to predict, however, that meaningful progress will depend on a more compatible assessment of the real technical possibilities of defense versus the political dangers. And there must be, I think, a common interpretation of the ABM Treaty and a recognition that security for each party depends vitally on the actions of the other. And a last point. The Soviets really believe that the basic defect in U.S. thinking is the failure to acknowledge the legitimate security concerns of the USSR. And they think this is a failure which breeds suspicion and miscalculation and ignores this inescapable condition of mutual vulnerability. Again, in that major speech to the Party Congress a year ago, Gorbachev said this, "The highest wisdom is in not caring exclusively for oneself, especially to the detriment of the other side. It is vital that everyone should feel equally secure." Well, I will close on that note, and I really believe that it would be hard to improve upon the wisdom of that final statement. Thank you very much.
Who would like to ask the first question? of Professor Kretzinger, and of biology.
You spoke of the pork barrel in the sky. Given the sort of transparent asininity of the FBI situation now, why has the collective leadership of the country been so ineffectual in opposing it?
That's a very good question. Because what you implied and what is happening, of course, is the militarization of American research to the neglect of all manner of other areas of great concern to our society: medical research, educational research, biological research. I can only speculate that the ultimate problem is the personal popularity of this president, that the Congress has been unwilling to oppose him on appropriations, and the appropriations have been large, although they are now beginning to diminish. I'm a little bit surprised at the alacrity with which the scientific community has grabbed for the money, including universities who have accepted a lot of money. One hears rumblings that individual researchers, particularly in university settings, are refusing to work on STI matters, but I honestly don't have a more than an impressionistic picture of what's happening. But it is it's a strange lapse. It's not the only one, of course, in relation to the president and his policies. There are a lot of other irrational policies that have gone without close scrutiny by Congress or the American people, simply because they like this man's personality.
Next questions. General Whitrat.
Mr. Secretary, you obviously oppose SDI. You mentioned specifically technical bases for that, right, and also for strategic reasons. Are you opposed also to a slower, more paced approach to research for the system?
No, I certainly am not.
And may I add a subscript to that? And where do you consider that research should end as far as the separation between, say, advanced development and testing?
Well, to answer your first question, I certainly do not oppose research into anything, and particularly into the possibilities of some ultimate defense system. And I think my opposition, like the opposition of my non-opposition, is based on both intellectual and pragmatic grounds. As a practical matter, you can't verify research. We assume that everyone is doing research, and we should. Indeed, I think it is a fact that we were doing a considerable amount of research before the president's speech in 1983, but it was proceeding on a much longer-term assumption. And what he did, really, was to bring it front and center and present at least the implication that an alternative strategy was at hand, or at hand in the near future. And put the imprimatur of the president on it. So the answer is I'm not at all opposed to a long-term program. I don't know that I could assign logically a dollar amount to that research, but I would say that it ought that dollar amount ought to be related importantly to the political implications of going ahead with a system under any circumstances, because I do think you don't go very far down the road with STI before you realize all of the consequences you're facing in terms of counter-reaction in the Soviet Union and elsewhere. And if, in fact, going ahead with STI, even if it should provide some increment of safety in a technical sense, would lead to profound increases of tension and complications with the other superpower, then I would think that it would be wrong to go ahead. I would also say that the amount of research should be related to the likelihood of success in the foreseeable future, and that we should not sacrifice research funds and research resources, human resources, per se, which could be much better applied to problems of medicine and education and other things that increase the richness of our civilian life and indeed of our economic productivity.
Is this at all analogous to the attitude people have had in the medical field? We've got doctors here. One of the things that impressed me with my colleagues in medicine at the Rockefeller Foundation was that they opposed the crash program in cancer research and heart research, that particularly cancer, that Nixon proposed. They did it on the grounds that for 30 years they had been working on cancer research, and they knew, moving through the various stages, virus research, all the other research, they knew that it was a long and painful process requiring great patience. I suppose the risk of drawing an analogy is that some would say that the destructiveness of missiles is so great that it puts you in another order of discourse.
Well, I would think the analogy is real, and particularly because it is my view that Star Wars, a major Star Wars effort, does not lead you to greater security. If that 1983 speech had been made by a philosopher in an academic setting, and he had held out the possibility of a population defense as an ultimate possibility, of course it wouldn't have created much of a stir, and it wouldn't have resulted in a $3 or $4 billion initial appropriation for research. What made this, of course, dramatically different was that the President of the United States made it. He made it passionately, and he made it appear that it was something quite easy within the realm of people who can go to the moon.
Next question. General Elliott.
Mr. Secretary, you hear a lot of people saying get rid of nuclear weapons entirely. And I remember in our origins of the defense of the Western world, NSC 68 and its derivatives.
Right.
Would you address the fact that at Reykjavik, we almost gave away the whole barn? And would you address the observation that at Reykjavik it was an unsorted, that it was probably the biggest step forward in my readings and experience with this problem that we've ever made? And how to get on from there with what's going on in Washington now? Do we stand a chance?
Well, to answer your first question, let me go back even beyond your question. I don't think there's a Chinaman's chance of eliminating nuclear weapons. And indeed, I just think it's impossible. You cannot in any event disinvent nuclear weapons, so that even if all of the powers that hold them now were to eliminate their stockpiles, there'd be the incipient danger that someone could build them clandestinely, and it becomes easier to build them in such a manner. So I don't think you're ever going to get rid of nuclear weapons, and for that reason alone, I would argue that the United States should never reduce its stockpile to zero. That I think deterrence is a very real stabilizing element in society in the nuclear era, and probably will remain so. Specifically with regard to Europe, I think it is quite clear, and I would say categorically, that the Europeans are never going to make the kind of effort to increase their conventional forces that would permit them to rely exclusively on a conventional defense. And you can argue about this. You can say that they are laggards and unwilling to make the economic sacrifice. But I think it's deeper than that. I think the Europeans are absolutely convinced, and they may be right on the physical facts, that they would be just as dead and just as destroyed in a long, drawn-out conventional war as they would be in a nuclear war. And therefore, they just don't think it's worth the candle. And they're really putting all of their reliance on nuclear deterrence, on the assumption that if nuclear deterrence fails, we are all lost. Just as if conventional deterrence fails and a long conventional war ensues that would be far more destructive than the Second World War, they are also lost. So I don't think you're going to get an incrementally greater effort from the Europeans, and I don't think you should. And therefore, we need a nuclear deterrent to maintain a confident defense of Europe. Now, it could take more than one form. Since the inception of NATO, the Europeans have been really dependent on the American nuclear deterrent. We get fixed in our minds about these things, but you know, it is not beyond the realm of certainly of economic possibility for the Europeans to develop their own collective nuclear deterrent someday. They have two existing forces now. And I think my own sense is that if they are going to insist on remaining dependent on nuclear weapons in that sense, then that is probably the direction that we should all go eventually, because I believe the credibility of the American willingness to go to the defense of Europe with nuclear weapons is becoming thinner and thinner. And many people have remarked on this, but an American president faced with the possibility that if he uses nuclear weapons in Europe, there will be immediate and widespread nuclear destruction in the United States, he's going to think very carefully. We are not in a posture of having a decided edge and having the Soviet Union in a position where they could not hurt us mortally. Have I answered your question?
You have indeed. So many people want to wish it away, and having lived 45 years under the umbrella, it's been very helpful to have you expose it to other people.
Well, I think that is the truth. And I don't think one needs to say any more than that. There are moral arguments that run against it. But I really do think the consequences of trying to go to zero nuclear weapons would be more complicating and more destabilizing than we can imagine at the moment.
Thank you. The second question will leave for history.
Other questions?
Yes, Mrs. Yonke.
Do you believe in nuclear winter and the fact that nuclear weapons used anywhere in the world would affect?
Well, first of all, let me say that I don't know much about it. I certainly am a non-technician. I've read things about it, and I do believe, I believe the conclusions of a number of scientists that nuclear winter is a very real possibility given a certain magnitude of nuclear explosions. I think it wouldn't occur if one or two went off, but if several thousand went off, I think it's a probability. From what I've read, and in a sense you can say it increases stability. In another sense, you can say that it makes it makes mankind subject to victimization by a reckless power. But I think it's something we should not take lightly.
Professor Lung has done work on China's nuclear strategy. Do you have any point you'd like to make or question you'd like to ask?
I think China now has reached a point of waiting to participate in serious armed control negotiations, even though in the past, it has refused to be involved in the superpower-sponsored agreement. But now, I think China is much more realistic in approaching the armed control issues. I think the point you made, it seemed to me it's very acceptable from the Chinese point of view. I think from their editorials, from their official pronouncements, I think they seem to follow the line of the reasoning you presented today.
Limiting nuclear weapons,
yeah.
And well, I find what you say encouraging. The Chinese attitude about nuclear weapons and nuclear arms control is a vast void in the American press, generally speaking, and I don't think many of us know much about it. But their participation in negotiations would be welcome but complicating, but I think future negotiations are going to have to take account of several nuclear powers, including China. Thank you.
Howard Cromwell.
Would you care to comment on the status of the proliferation of nuclear arms, especially in reference to Israel? We hear so much about Israel is trying to keep secret their program.
Well, again, I must confess that this is a subject that I don't know in detail about currently. With specific respect to Israel, I think there is a general assumption in the informed community that Israel has a nuclear capability. Under what circumstances they would be willing to use it, one does not know, but one shudders at the prospect. With regard to the general so-called horizontal proliferation problem, I believe several things have happened in the last few years. There have been countries like Pakistan that have moved closer to a nuclear weapons capability. There seem to have been a number of other countries with the potential who have decided politically not to do it. They have looked at the complications and have decided, for one reason or another, that their security is not enhanced and they'd be better off to be in a nuclear-free zone, let's say. I can't give you specific examples, unfortunately, but that seems to be a trend among some of the middle powers who have the economic and technical potential to do it.
Knight Aldridge.
Mr. Secretary, do you believe that the present commitment of this country to SDI is reversible? And if so, do you believe it will continue to be reversible 2 years from now?
I think it's reversible. I think two things are happening. Congress is becoming more alert to the irrationalities of the program, the political complications that arise for any hoped for improvements with the Russians, and they're also beginning to be very seriously concerned about cost. If the president's projected appropriations for this were to be honored, SDI would rapidly become the single most expensive military program on the boards, and this will also have a negative impact on the professional military people, on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in my view, and I think we've already begun to see some manifestations of this, because whatever the chief's position may be, and they may, other things being equal, like the idea of a defense, they won't like the idea of its impacting heavily on programs that they regard as far more fundamental to the defense establishment. And given the context of our national deficit, it seems to be inevitably, whether we're dealing with a Republican or a Democratic-dominated Congress, that there are going to have to be some trade-offs here. And if you have a missionary in the White House who wants and can get SDI, then a number of other military programs are going to be sacrificed. And I think you will find probably vocal opposition from the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that point. I am hopeful, but of course it's just a speculation, that SDI is entirely reversible, or in the sense that the general suggested, is simply relegated to a far more justifiable long-term, lower visibility research program, so that we can in fact get on with major agreements with the Soviet Union across a military and a political spectrum. And if I may, just for a second here, say, I believe that a new generation has come to power in the Soviet Union that we should all be studying much more astutely than we have to date. The people, Gorbachev is not alone in his views. My experience is that the younger group of officials and academics who are very close to him and to the government there represent his view. they are basically far better educated, more exposed to the outside world, far more aware of the limitations of Soviet power and of anybody's power, far more anxious to create the international conditions that will permit the internal modernization of Soviet society, which is terribly backward, as everyone knows. And I think it's a great opportunity. I said in this, in these prepared remarks, that I don't think these remarkably forthcoming arms control proposals from Gorbachev are a tactical ploy. I think the Soviets are going to stay with those. And if necessary, they're going to outweigh Reagan and deal with his successor, whoever he be. I'm very encouraged. Again, I'm sorry to extend this answer, but in a group called the American Committee for U.S.-Soviet Relations, an organization that was founded by George Kennan and some others about 12 years ago, we have an ongoing project with an American committee and a Soviet committee that is seeking to devise a series of tangible measures that each side could take that would increase the stability of coexistence. And we, in fact, are meeting with the Russians down at the Aspen Institute on the Eastern Shore this weekend. It'll be the second meeting. And I find it extremely encouraging to see the quality of mind in these younger Russians.
It seems to me that to achieve stability in the world, that you've got to have agreement on ends as well as means. And in this discussion, we've been talking about means, and SDI is simply the last effort to build more and more expensive and complicated defense systems. Now, throughout history, nations have built power and maintained power generally because of clearly known objectives for which that power would be used. And I think you go all the way through. When you see a nation building power, you know in advance exactly what the objectives of that nation are and how that power is to be used and for what end. And so I'm wondering whether you would address the question of ends in connection with the current arms race. What are all of these weapons really being maintained to achieve? How are they to be used? For what end are they to be used?
The fundamental question. I would say that to put the to accept the leadership of both countries at their word, they are seeking to protect their own societies so that their own societies can evolve in their own ways from now to infinity. There is a demonology, of course, connected to the interpretations of both sides. Some here believe that the Soviets are building to put themselves in a posture where they could strike us with impunity and destroy our society. And there are plenty of Soviets who believe that Reagan is seeking a superior position, particularly with SDI, from which he could dominate the political relationship with the Soviet Union. And a part of that is the so-called nuclear warfighting strategy that projects the idea of a protracted nuclear war lasting over months or years, which nobody really believes could happen. So I think that leaving ideology aside for the moment, and well, you can't leave ideology aside, but both countries are in a sense messianic powers. We would like to see a democratic world, a world of democratic nation states, and they would like to see their own mirror image throughout the world. Neither has either the willpower or the resources to bring that about. So there's going to be a continuing inconclusive competition. Given the nature of nuclear weapons, given the fact, as you said eloquently, that the use of military power today destroys all the political objectives and therefore serve no purpose by being used, we are in this situation where we have to recognize that we share a common security problem, and admitting all of the fundamental differences in our systems, we have to, in a sense, finesse that question and agree that war between us would be impermissible, and that is the only condition which will permit our respective societies to develop as they're going to develop and change as they're going to develop. And let us compete in all of the areas like economics and politics and culture, but let us avoid nuclear war. There's been an implicit pact to that effect, of course, since the end of the Second World War. Let us hope it continues.
May I ask a concluding question? Would you comment? One of the talk shows, as he's done before, former Secretary Kissinger put forward the view that President Reagan had in effect been entrapped at Reykjavik, that Gorbachev brought a very far-reaching radical proposal that had never been discussed, that the administration was unable to fully vet at the meeting. He said when Gorbachev therefore made the 5-year proposal, Reagan countered it with a 10-year proposal, and that proved that we were unprepared to discuss the plan. Is there any validity, or how would you assess that?
Well, from what I know, and of course I don't think anybody is entirely sure about what happened at Reykjavik, because I think this administration has a record for imprecision that is unexcelled, but it appears that this negotiation kind of grew like Topsy, that there was agreement, or there had been a prior discussion of the 50% offensive reduction for certain restrictions on SDI, and then I believe it is true that President Reagan raised the ante by saying, why don't we get rid of all ballistic missiles? And Gorbachev presumably at that point said, well, while we're at it, why don't we get rid of all nuclear weapons? And by that time, they were both on cloud nine, and neither side, I think, was fully staffed to deal with the implications. Certainly not the American side. But I don't think, I don't put much weight in the idea of entrapment. I think that Mr. Reagan may have been carried away by enthusiasm, but it was not an ideal way to conduct a meeting between the two most important heads of state.
Well, I know you all join me in thanking Secretary Hoops for this stimulating and challenging presentation. We appreciate his taking time prior to meetings with the Russian group to present these ideas, and some of you, I think, in the future will want to read them and reflect on them, and you may have even further questions you want to raise then, but certainly been one of the most stimulating talks that we've had. Thank you very much.